Hello and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, season 12, Peaks Chats. My name is Magellan, and when I saw them tonight, I knew exactly what I believed. It's like, if we could put our hearts together and keep them that way forever, we'd be safe, no matter what. Them and me. From now on. It's Alan.
Them and me. Just you and I.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
Okay.
Little pretty light good. Motif, little heavy motif. We got motifs going everywhere.
Heavy-handed motif.
Hi, Magellan. Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to Peaks Chats, where we watch two episodes of Twin Peaks per week. This week, we are splitting our discussions into two separate episodes, but you'll get two of them in this week. And for the first half here, we have a special guest. Alan, isn't that exciting?
It's thrilling. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
And she reminds me today of a small Mexican chihuahua. It's Jen from Scanline Media. What's up, Jen?
Hey there. Not much. It's been pretty eventful last week just because I've been moving my stuff all around. But thankfully, that probably means my acoustics might be better than they were when we when I last appeared on a Chats podcast.
There you go. And that's that chihuahua energy, that frantic moving around you've had to be doing.
Indeed.
Well, we're glad to have you here to discuss season 2, episode 6, Demons. Demons was directed by Leslie Linka Glatter, written by Harley Payton and Robert Engels. It aired on November 3rd, 1990. Alan, what happened in Demons?
Alan, what happened? Says my boss to me whenever I spill milk everywhere.
Sorry, didn't mean to make it feel that way.
It's okay. We're in a safe space here where I can tell you that. In this episode, James saves the girls from a tormented Harold. Cooper brings Audrey home. Bobby and Shelley learn that their insurance plans have backfired. Donna tries to convince Truman that Harold Smith has Laura's secret diary. I don't like the wording of that, by the way, because he does have it. Finally, Gordon Cole arrives on the scene with Albert's newest report before the investigation team interviews Mike. He is the spirit inside of Philip Gerard, and his clues point Cooper towards Bob, who is hiding in the Great Northern.
Lightning.
Mid-season excitement. So, I want to start by saying again, thank you, Jen, a good friend of the podcast. Always like to have you on shows with us. And
yeah.
Want to know your history both with Twin Peaks and with this sort of chunk of the series. I know I gave you a wide swath of episodes to pick from, and you ended up landing with Demons. So I'm curious why you also picked this episode.
Yeah, so I started watching Twin Peaks within a year after the Showtime revival was announced. Ended up watching it off Hulu or Netflix, whichever one had it at that time. And I remember really struggling to get through some of these season 2 episodes, which I think is pretty common with a lot of folks. But I specifically went with Demons because it's the introduction of Gordon Cole, finally the first time that you get to see him. And his whole bit is just that he's David Lynch pretending to have a hearing problem. And there's something about the way that this show portrays the FBI, which is obviously nothing compared to real life, but I almost find the various FBI characters comforting in a way. Whenever I think about my favorite characters, I'm thinking about Dale Cooper. I'm thinking about why am I blanking on the character's name, but I know he's played by Miguel Ferrer.
Yeah, Albert.
Yeah. Albert, Gordon, Denise to some level. There's just something about the way that they are shown in this series where they're a comforting presence, and whenever they're around, you feel like things will be, if not totally under control, then things will be somewhat secure. And that's a nice feeling in a show where anytime you step outside, you have to worry about a freaking owl spying on you.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It's funny that the show is really, really leaning hard into the owls this season, because it does feel whenever somebody's outside, it's just so you know, still not what they seem, still watching, and there are still rustlings in the trees every single time we do a scene transition. Do I still like it? The answer is yes. but yeah, I agree. This is a great one, and the much anticipated full introduction of Gordon Cole in the flesh brings to Twin Peaks another character with a, I guess, a form of disability that I find really fascinating in the way that it's made not only comedic, but handled legitimately. A person who is hard of hearing, a person who uses a hearing aid proudly and doesn't try to, like, cover it up or, like, apologize for it more than once or twice. Gordon is fully, like, he's accepting of his position in life and is just, a really lovable character right away. He ingratiates himself with the crew immediately.
I actually have a clip of his introduction where I wanted to clip, like, a line or two, but there's this straight 45 seconds or a minute or something where he's, like, introducing himself, says some great lines, talks about what you're talking about, Alan. So let me just drop that in here.
Federal Bureau of Investigation Regional Bureau Chief Gordon Cole. That's a real mouthful, but I can't hear myself anyway. I'm Agent Cooper's supervisor.
Well, pleasure to meet you.
Can I speak with you a moment?
Sure. Donna, wait here.
And who did you say you were?
I'm Sheriff Truman.
Great. Pay dirt. You'll have to speak up, Sheriff. Hearing's gone. Long story. Got these things cranked up to the max.
Are you looking for Agent Cooper?
When an agent goes down in the field, I jump right up and pay a visit.
Agent Cooper's not here right now.
Albert Rosenfield will not be coming back, but I've got his lab report right here. Item, a vicuna coat. Albert found fibers in the hall outside of Cooper's room from a vicuna coat.
Coat was vicuna.
Sounds real good, Sheriff, but I already ate.
I had to cut it on that line, of course.
Yeah, there's something about the way that they do have those classic hearing gags you see in various bits of media where someone will say something to him and he completely misunderstands, but more often than not, he'll end up... Someone will suggest they go somewhere and then he'll end up suggesting it like a second later, not realizing that it's already been said. And right. It feels like... Mm-hmm. It feels like he's always still pointing in the right direction, even when there's some kerfuffle when he tries to communicate.
Yeah, like the bit where Cooper shows up later.
Agent Dale Cooper!
And Cooper is like, oh, Gordon, what's up? And Gordon says, oh, no need to apologize. I've been having a great time. And Cooper, like, didn't apologize, but probably should have. That whole exchange is pretty fun, too.
Well, what's so funny about the way that they write Gordon misunderstanding people is you can almost piece together what he thought the other person said. Like, mm-hmm. when they talk about the guy, when Truman says it's a coat made of vicuna, and he says, like, that sounds delicious, but I already ate, he's probably hearing him say, like, a sandwich of tuna. And you're like, oh, wait. And it all works. I was, like, noticing that. Like, you could totally understand what Gordon is hearing. Or at least something close to it, which I think is a really good touch.
Jen, you're right that a lot of the time some of the jokes are very, like, broad gag, almost at his expense. But also, I feel like a lot of the time when there's a miscommunication, it's portrayed more so as, like, the mistake of the person talking to Gordon not being clear enough. Mm-hmm. Like, when Truman says the thing that Gordon hears is, like, thanks, I already ate. It's because Truman is, like, mumbling to himself and not really saying anything of substance. And that's a tricky thing, but I think that ends up happening often enough that you can have fun with Gordon Cole rather than how it could have gone if they'd handled it differently.
Totally. It's one of those situations where you get the sense that the people around him just need to be better about speaking up like he asked them to speak up.
Right, because he lays it out at the beginning. He's like, this is my deal. This is what we need to do. Yeah.
You will be you will like be able to assist me and make this conversation accessible to me. I'm not bending to your will here. Like the part later when I laughed so hard when he's telling Cooper about like the secret chess move that Wyndham Earle sent to Cooper. And then Truman like knows that they're about to talk some secret stuff and he pops in to be like, just a heads up. We can hear everything you're saying in the other room. So just be aware if you're saying like some cool secret shit, we hear you. And he's just like, yeah, well, all right, come in here. Like we're going to talk about it then. I think it's obviously the benefit of like being someone who works on the show, but Gordon Cole just gets to put himself in the best plot lines of the series. And that continues for a while, as I remember. Like, he just gets to be there for the interview at the end of this. And it's like, oh, you just got here and you're already, like, in this crucial, like, fascinating moment of, like, supernatural stuff. Which I just, I think is really exciting. He brings a good energy to the show.
Yeah, I'd be really curious to read more about, like, David Lynch's position in the show as this was happening, because, like, when he's finally getting introduced in person, like, it's around the time when he's not writing or directing it anymore, so other people are supposedly writing the lines that he's saying at this point.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that and found that to be a strange tension that I'd love to learn more about, too.
I want to loop back to the whole discussion of this three moments in this episode that make me think about the healthcare system, how we treat the disabled, and the ways that can be positive or negative in television. Yep. They are Gordon Cole, they are Mike, and it is Leo, obviously. So we can hit each of those tentpoles as we go throughout our discussion. But we can briefly touch on just the top of the episode. They're wrapping up the end of the Orchid's Curse. James saves the day, decides to be a cool dude, and rescue Maddie and Donna from the evil Herald. And again, I guess that's actually also a, like, sort of disability thing, right? Is they're like, oh, he can't chase us, he can't go outside. And it's just like, the way that they talk about Harold's agoraphobia always feels like, not punching down, it's more just like acknowledging it, but they don't want us to forget about it. They, like, keep bringing it up around him. I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah, the moment where it became a mechanic in the plot is when I was like, I don't know about this one, guys. When you're sort of spending time with him, when Donna is learning about him and who he is, I think they did a decent job with it. But yeah, in that moment where it's like some invisible force field and he's not able to exit or something, it's like, okay, you've turned this guy into a plot device and not a person.
I don't know if it was at the beginning of this episode or the end of last episode, but the bit where he just takes the garden rake and scrapes it over his face, like...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like the very Vega end of the last Street episode.
Yeah, it was very much like a... We somehow aren't making this person scary enough, despite the fact that two people are in his house and he supposedly... He would presumably have control over a situation like that, so let's have him do something creepy to himself.
Yeah,
and it felt like it pushed things a bit too over the edge for me.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then the bit where he's like, I don't know, right after they leave, and he's like trying to water his plants, but he can't water his plant. I don't know. It's like, this guy's a guy. He's real. You can have him just cry, and that's fine.
He doesn't have to rake his face with the thing. He doesn't have to, like, shake and like, have this. His trauma response is I'm not going to say unrealistic, but it's just, like, it's heightened for drama in a way that doesn't feel believable. Which is, again, contrasting, like, Gordon's, like, you know, deafness, which is very much just like, hey, this is what I have, deal with it.
Very,
like,
matter of fact, yeah.
Yeah. He kind of takes control of it. Speaking of plot lines that are brief, but I guess interesting, Audrey's okay, or potentially okay, but her relationship with her dad...
She's okay in a certain way, I guess, and very much not okay in other ways, yeah.
Out of the frying pan and into the flame, so to speak. No longer in the clutches of the evil Jean Renault, who they try to give us lore for in this episode, or backstory, and not everything has to be lore. They try to give him backstory, and it's like, guys... Stop trying to make Jean Reno a thing. Nobody likes this man.
Not interested.
He's just an evil French Canadian, and that's okay. You're allowed. And they're like, he's the older brother of the three, and he's protective and wants revenge. And
he rules the Northern Territories with an iron fist. It's like, shut up.
It's like a Yakuza boss or something. Yeah,
he's not in Game of Thrones or something. Let's stop.
I just don't need to see more of him. But yeah, Audrey's back. Cooper wants to take care of her and, like, be around. And then Ben is like, my daughter's back. I care about a human being. Or do I? I don't read anything Ben does in this entire episode as legit. Not with Mr. Tajimura, not with his daughter, not with anyone.
Yeah, the way that he interacts with his daughter in terms of basically, Audrey mentions, hey, I want Dale to drive me home. And Ben immediately jumps in being like, hey, why don't the three of us go together? It all seems like he's just trying to push things under the rug because he knows that Audrey must know at this point that he owns that place. And he does not want Audrey and Cooper in the same room at all. At this moment or perhaps ever so that she can't talk about it.
And this is the exchange that they have after Ben has learned where she was, after he's learned that she was forcibly given heroin. He goes to see her and he's like, gives her some poetic speech that's totally fake. And then they have this exchange.
The things that you must have seen.
I saw so much.
We'll sort it out. Together.
Yes, Daddy.
Ooh.
You and I.
That's my girl.
So creepy. And moments before that, also, he like shushes her when she's hinting at the fact that he's associated with One-Eyed Jax. It's terrible. And that moment where he's like, oh, you must have seen so much, is not him empathizing. It's him digging for information. Ugh. And then, of course, you're meant to think about the last time that he loomed over her in a bed. And that must be going through Audrey's mind, too. And it's just all so, so upsetting.
I have a comment about the shitty men on the show. A friend of ours recently was messaging me as they're catching up to Twin Peaks. And they were like, all of the men suck on this show. And I was like, yeah, that's the point. And they were like, does the show like that? Is it like interested in exploring why people are like that? And if so, like, does it give retribution to the women who are affected by these evil men? And I kind of found myself struggling with how to answer that also without like, you know, spoiling it. But like, in some ways, yeah, sometimes women get to like be powerful. But then sometimes Shelley almost kills her husband, doesn't. And then like lets her boyfriend take care of it. And it's like, it's kind of hard to champion Twin Peaks as a like feminist masterpiece when like week after week after week, we are just like, yep, this guy still sucks. This guy still sucks. All right. Well, this guy sucks too. I guess that's the point. And it's like, where's the arc for that? I guess. Because Ben just fully sucks. And I don't remember when Ben, I have like memories of it, but the Ben arc is just so weird and mired in like creepy stuff with his daughter and also like the stuff with Mr. Tajimura, which we can briefly mention here. He has a conversation with Mr. Tajimura, who talks to him about how his family was at Nagasaki, so he knows all about fire. Of course, fire is a recurring motif in Twin Peaks. They've mentioned it multiple times. Mr. Tajimura is just it's rough. And I think we agreed before pod, we need to talk about that scene a little bit more in depth, but it would require us to spoil it. So if you want to hear about our thoughts on Mr. Tajimura and that whole situation with him and Ben, listen to after the pod for that, because we can't really get into it right now without revealing a lot of things.
Yeah, I think for now it's worth returning to what you were just bringing up around the men in the show, and if we sort of get to the root of the evil things that they do and why they do them, and if there's some sort of justice, I mean, I think that's the issue with this sort of story being written and filmed by predominantly men. I mean, we're seeing in the credits that there are obviously women involved in the creation of the show. So not to discount their contributions. And I'm sure, you know, that's no small part of why we get some of the moments of agency that we get. But ultimately, like, I don't know, this is a show that ogles its female characters, and it's a show that wants us to think that Ben Horn is like kind of charming sometimes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, dealing with the, I don't know, the dualities of that and the kind of inherent self-contradiction of that. It's hard to navigate, I think. And I can't really say more about it without spoiling things, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. like, Jerry Horn doesn't appear in this episode at all, but I always think about how whenever Ben and Jerry have a scene together, I'm just adoring the way that these two interact with one another. And then all of a sudden, Jerry will break out, "Hey, you want to go to One Eye Jackson, spend some time with the new girls?" And it's interesting feeling these conflicting feelings while watching it, but also it doesn't feel like the show acknowledges these conflicting feelings at all, or dives into how other people around them might have similar reactions to seeing them talk about more innocent things together versus seeing them do some wicked shit.
Well, you make a good point, Jen, and I think it's something we can like loop back around to as we see more of the show. But like Cooper in this episode mentions that, you know, he says, I'm not all bad, like I'm not all good. I've had like my mistakes I've made in the past. And I sort of think you could argue the thesis of the show, like even with Cooper or with Jerry and Ben, is that we think on a surface level, these characters are so fun and charming and likable. I mean, Cooper is a meme at this point because of all his love for food and coffee. But like even he has dark parts of his life. Even Ben and Jerry, who are like so charming and funny, are like deeply troubled, awful pieces of crap. And the show is telling us like these two things exist in tandem. We have good and bad parts of ourselves in everybody, and those both of those parts need to be acknowledged and reconciled, because nobody is entirely evil or entirely good. I think that is, if we're going to pull something literary out of all of this, that's what it's going for. It's just like, hey, these guys suck, but sometimes they on the surface they seem okay. Not to say that they are, but that they seem like it. So I think that stuff is going to be really interesting to keep an eye on. And again, we'll talk Tachimura stuff later. But a plot line that just fully disappoints me in every way is the whole thing with Josie and her family member and Truman. What's going on here, guys? Can somebody break this down?
It feels very much like, from that specific period of the 90s, there was a lot of, and late 80s, there was a lot of rising sun scare about Japanese businessmen coming into situations, taking over, and doing quote-unquote bad things. And it feels like some of that is bleeding into Twin Peaks with season 2 and the way that they portray this other person who comes in and starts threatening Josie and getting in between Truman and Josie.
And I mean, we've definitely seen white male characters do nasty things, but there was something about starting the scene with a tight close-up him putting his pants back on, and then the multiple moments in the scene where he has his hand on Josie's neck and he's like twisting his face in sinister, like, I'm going to take you back and you got to leave tonight. And it's like, why are we directing this way? It feels like it's meant to be more sinister than Ben Horn, right? Like, we've never seen Ben Horn cinch his pants back up, and God knows the kinds of stuff that he's done. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So there were just some choices here in the way that this guy was depicted,
and the fact that like some of those
depicted too.
Exactly, some of those shots are tight parts of Josie in like a skimpy dress, and it's like
the camera. Totally like goes across her whole body before we even get to her face, and she's crying and clearly has gone through a really upsetting situation with this guy. But first, it's like, no, let's look at her whole body and her back exposed in the dress. And it's like, why? Why are we doing this?
Yeah, there's no like symbolic defense of that camera work. That's just, hey, it's cable or whatever. It's network, and we're trying to like get people excited on a Friday night or whatever. Just come on, guys. And it's what really bums me out is not only that, like Josie is being portrayed as more and more of a shrewd person. She has like the scene with Ben where she's like, I'm getting my money right now. But that's because she's being manipulated. And when she goes back to the guy later, and Truman is the hero of that scene later, where he's like, you get out of here, man. I'm talking to Josie. Josie, you can't go with him. And it just rips all like agency away from her. Even as she's like the one who has started power in a scene, that is because she's being manipulated. Every scene involving her is being controlled by men. It's like there's no substance to Josie at all other than her physical body, and it really sucks.
She does have that key, though. Can I play that clip real quick?
She does have that cool key, yeah.
Josie.
This is Ben threatening her.
This key unlocks my personal hotel safe. Now, in that safe, I have put together a fascinating dossier on you, my dear, and your late husband Andrew's little boat that went boom. So, you behave yourself, lady. Or believe me when I say that I will bury you.
That's a shame. Because if anything unfortunate were to happen to me, it would lead authorities to a certain safety deposit box in a bank in another city, inside of which there is enough evidence to lock you away for 3 lifetimes. They'll bury us side by side.
Stalemate. I mean, that scene's pretty cool. Give us more Josie like that. That would be nice.
That's, but then he also like kisses her or something, right?
Maybe, I don't remember.
He like gets touchy with. He gets all excited, like, "Oh, you were a badass. That's kind of awesome." It just, yes, that's a great moment. When she had the key, I did pop off a little bit. I was like, "There we go. Josie Packard's got the agency. She's got the thing in control. She wants her money." But it's probably 80 to 85% of her scenes are just men being like, "I control you. No, I control you. No, I do." And it's, I'm tired is what I am of that plot line. I keep trying to come up with these like incredible segues. And I was going to say, speaking of control, let's talk about Leo. But I'd actually ask that you cut that from the script, which, because this whole podcast is scripted. Uh-huh. And I'm just going to seamlessly transition by saying Bobby, Shelley, and Leo are hanging out in Shelley's house. And it goes weirdly.
The first, before that happens, the first scene we get with them is Bobby and Shelley finally getting their check. And
oh, yeah.
And this is how that goes for them.
Your check.
Thank you. There must be a mistake.
$700.
Sad. The cost of healthcare is going through the roof.
It's bringing rain. We're supposed to get $5,000 a month.
What will the figure state and local taxes, equipment fees, medical and maintenance costs, administrative fees? Wait, you see the results? Fortunately, with you two here, Mr. Johnson will be more than adequately provided for. Good luck. I'll find my own way up.
A little social commentary there about our healthcare system.
If it's 5,000, but then minus all the fees, why would you ever say it's 5,000? Like, why? Just tell them it's 700 from the top.
Well, because that's how checks work. Like, your job or the government, they're going to tell you the amount that they write on the check. I don't know, or the amount that they disperse and then gets cut up.
I suppose it just, and it's also just an absurd percentage, but I guess that's part of the joke, and that's the criticism of the healthcare system.
Right.
Yeah. All the way back in 1990. That's that's how long people have known that the healthcare here is a joke. Mm-hmm.
And look how it's changed. Wait. I regret to inform you, it has not. Jen, I want to ask you what you thought about Bobby and Shelley flirting and face kissing while Leo
face
is
having
semi-comatose next to them.
I think there's an interesting tension there because, like, this is the person who has tried to kill both of them, like, at the end of the last season, and now he's just in there all the time, and, like, they try and have fun with it by giving him a little party hat and a kazoo, and, but there's still this thought in the back of your head, like, he could really wake up at any moment, and what is going to happen if that does happen, even when they're dressing it up with ridiculous, even when they're basically taunting him as it happens.
Yeah, and the way that they, like, once Shelley sees him move his face, and they're like, oh, we actually have to be decent. They're still not kind to him, mind you, once they realize that he's moving.
Yeah, Bobby's like, oh, I wouldn't want to exploit the guy after he was exploiting him for hours and hours straight.
Exactly. And it's like, you guys, I think that this is the show asking us where our empathy lies here. Because like, yeah, exactly as Jen said, Leo is an awful person. We spent a lot of the show thinking that Leo killed Laura Palmer. At this point, it's still a question mark. But like, Leo sucks, and now he's getting a form of just desserts, a form of payback. But like, is this the payback that we wanted? Do we want to watch a semi-comatose man watch as his wife, flirts with, makes out with, and ridicules him in front of his eyes in a way that he can't control? I mean, that's a living nightmare, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, do we feel like that's okay? The show knows it's funny. They put a party hat on him and they give, you know, funny lines to Bobby and Shelley. But like, I still feel really uncomfortable watching this. And I don't know if that's like my empathy meter just lies differently than Shelley and Bobby's. But
well,
it still feels like they are.
No, I mean, I think you're asking the question that Shelley's asking of herself, right? Like, I think that's actually the purpose of the scene, is not to give you an answer. Bobby has an answer. He goes into this whole thing about like, okay, Leo, here's all the terrible stuff you did. This is your life. Welcome to it. Or this is what you deserve or whatever. But then when Bobby and Shelley go to the table to presumably have sex in front of him, we get a close-up shot of Shelley's face looking at Leo, asking herself that question when they're about to do that, of like, okay, this guy has treated me in, you know, the worst way, and this is a moment where I can sort of assert like, okay, well, you know what? Fuck you. I'm going to have sex with my boyfriend right here. You can't do anything about it. And I think she's asking like, is that what I want? Is that justice or retribution? And I think the scene does a good job of asking that question and not posing an answer, because there isn't one present here, I don't think.
It's the same as when she pulls the gun out and she feels regret about like, did I really want to shoot my husband? Am I sad that I did it, or sad that he lived through it? You know, it's underlining that moment for her.
Totally. Weirdly enough, I feel like I'm siding with Bobby for once, just in terms of like, he goes into, he explains in excruciating detail how Leo used to hit Shelley with a bar of soap within a sock, and how that caused internal injuries that he could easily hide, as well as external injuries. Mm-hmm. And if you do that to someone, I'm not exactly feeling too sorry for Leo at this moment,
right,
regardless of what's happening to him.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly, though. Like, there are very valid arguments to different sides of this. Like, yeah, do I think he should be harmed? Maybe in some ways. Do I think he should be punished? Absolutely. But like, where are the degrees of that? I think it's for each person to decide, just like the mysteries of the show are for every person to decide, like how they interpret them. And that can sometimes rub people the wrong way, because it's like, why doesn't the show tell me how to feel about Leo? Or why doesn't the show answer X and Y question about its mysteries or its mythology? Because I think the show is very open-ended, and that's one of the things I like about it a lot. But yeah, they like dance in front of him and like are going to have some sex, and they make out, and then
Bobby drops his face in the cake for a moment.
I guess by accident.
Yeah. And then he says, it's good we didn't light the candles, which Shelley relaxing and laughing at that was a pretty nice moment.
Right. Right. Bobby knows how weird this is, and he's like, like, I can cut this tension a little bit.
Yeah.
It is funny that there are like this and then the mic scene have like underscore music throughout them. And in this one, it's just Leo humming, like putting air into the kazoo, not even blowing into it, obviously, but just like air is coming out of, he's breathing into, there you go, he's breathing into a kazoo. And it's just, you hear through this entire scene, and it adds a good level of commentary to it. Comedy. This is like the only Leo scene that I remember from here on out. We're in like unknown territory for me at this point. And we have two more plot lines that I wanted to discuss. We have Leland and Ben. So here's something spooky. The true horror of Twin Peaks is lawyers, the legal system, because Leland is back on his BS. He's here with Ben. He's like, Jerry's out of town. I'm here to be normal again. Hi, I'm smiling. We're dancing. We're at the Great Northern. Let's do tax fraud. He lays out this beautiful, extremely in-depth plan on how to realistically commit tax fraud using multiple laundering schemes at once, and how to keep, quote, pocket money and use escrow and all this stuff. And it's like, we have never seen Leland Palmer be a lawyer. And now that he's finally, like, quote unquote, back in action, that's what I like to call this white-haired version of Leland, is Leland colon back in action, is he's like, all right, so we're going to steal money from these guys, we're going to hide it on the Cayman Islands, and we're going to make off like bandits. It's going to be sick, dude. Let's do it.
Yeah, I feel like from the very opening of the show, it's portraying Leland in sort of a sympathetic light compared to the other, compared to the Horn brothers. It just seems like, due to circumstance, he's working for them, and like, you get to spend like a minute seeing him in his job just pitching this real estate project to these Icelandic people. And because of that, when he finally shows up, you are the show more or less answers the question you've been wondering, like, why has he been working with the Horns for this long? And the answer is, oh yeah, he has that energy in him just like they do.
Yeah, he sucks too.
He can pull that energy out of him also at will. And he just always had it. But yeah, him and Ben are planning some awful stuff. I don't remember if Jerry like comes back or if he just is not on the show anymore, which would make me sad because I like Jerry a lot. But I liked him. They didn't really explain why he was. I guess they were just like, he's traveling doing business things, which is fine. But there's not much more to that one. I forgot to mention. There's just the scene
later.
Oh, yeah, the singing. Yeah.
Where Leland's singing at the bar in the Great Northern, and he's singing a song from, as King Pete Martell says, The King and I.
Pete Martell, sitting at the bar, turns around there to look at the camera and goes, hey, The King and I. Thank you.
Yeah. But it's just another classic Leland singing moment, and we'll talk about it later, I guess.
Yeah, Leland is singing The King and I, singing Getting to Know Me, which is an interesting song, and Ben's kind of getting into it. They like sort of do a duet at one point, which is charming. Mm-hmm. And then he like does like that, the lounge singer thing where he goes up to a random couple and he's like, where are you from? And they're like, we're from Twin Peaks. And he's like, beautiful area, beautiful area.
Ben does have a good, both Ben and Jerry have the ability to like see when Leland is doing this again, move in and diffuse it either by joining in or just doing small talk and getting away from the group. Like, it seems like they've gotten used to just moving in by now.
They're ready. They, them and like when Catherine was doing the dance before, people always are ready to do something when Leland is quote unquote on his shit. We did forget to mention a brief one, just a brief, I just want to talk about Nadine for like 30 seconds, y'all. Holy crap. So yeah. Nadine's, yes, you have a clip? Give me it.
Yeah, so Nadine is coming home from shopping. She's surprised that they didn't look at her twice when she used the charge card, as she says. And then she says the following to Ed.
Say, Ed, when do my parents get back from Europe anyway?
Well, pretty soon.
It is neat having the place all to ourselves. Pretend it's ours, like we're married or something.
Well, we can do that, Nadine.
There's some other stuff we can do, too.
Well, like what?
You know, silly.
Watch Jeopardy.
You know what I was thinking? Tonight, maybe we could go park by the lake and neck. Wait a minute. We don't have to go anywhere. Why, we can just stay right here.
The leap that Nadine does to get onto the couch,
where
her knee and foot are perfectly positioned, it was unreal. Like, that was a really impressive leap. I don't know. It was pretty good.
What's the actress's name? I wrote it down here. The actress who plays Nadine is in her mid-30s at this point. And that is some acrobatics that I, at 27, cannot do. She's 37. Yeah, no, Wendy Robbie. Wendy Robbie's the actress's name. Just very physical, very, like, in your face. I love the writing here where it's like, that is how you at 15, 16 talk about sex. Not necessarily like, let's go neck, but like, let's go do something else. Like, you wouldn't dare say it, but you know what we're talking about. I love that, the comedy of that. This is why I'm like, I was trying to defend the Nadine stuff in a recent podcast is like, yeah, it's random and it doesn't necessarily tie into the rest of the show, but it provides a lot of needed levity after all of the heavy stuff that we deal with.
Yeah, Everett McGill just completely sells this absolute terror of, oh God, she wants to have sex and she's thinking like she has the same, she's continuously underestimating her energy. So
I'm gonna die.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just constantly thinking the faces he's making, he must be thinking, oh shit, is this it? Am I gonna die here?
Yes. She like rips him in the stomach and he almost cracks a rib, like in this scene.
He kind of, when Nadine's like, we could do something else, he kind of gives a little grin.
It's like, yeah. Oh,
Ed, are you having sex with your wife who thinks she's a teenage girl right now? Are you doing that?
What's the optics there? Is that weird?
what's happening there, Ed?
Anyway. It's funny. I enjoy it a lot. I think it's just, it's the performances that bring so much to it. But yeah, it's really good. And then the final scene. Let's get into it, kids.
What about James and Maddie?
We talked about that. Sure.
There's the whole conversation, the heart-to-heart that James and Maddie have.
They do talk a lot about love. But let's see. It's kind of like they shore up their debts here. They're like, all right, let's figure out who's in love with who and who needs to go where right now.
Yeah, it's a little convenient. And Maddie weirdly flips from in previous episodes where she was like, I hate that everybody thinks I'm Laura, to saying to James, I like it when people think I'm Laura and I can read Laura's mind also. But then I really like this exchange that they have where Maddie said, well, you looked at me and you saw Laura and you like that and I like that. And James says,
what was wrong?
It wasn't one thing or the other. For a while, I got to be somebody different. But now I'm just me again. James, you and Dawn belong together. It's the best thing.
I mean, I don't know about that part, but the whole... I just really like Maddie's kind of non-judgmental takeaway from this really bizarre and upsetting experience that she's had. Just like, yeah, it happened. This is what we experienced. There's not a right or a wrong here. It's just the reality. Very mature. Very, I don't know. So I like that. I thought it was well acted. And, I also liked the duality of like she's saying you and Donna should be together at the same time that she's squeezing his knee and kind of forgets to let go.
There's a tension there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just great and very mature that Maddie is like, yeah, I should probably leave.
All right, finally. We've been saying this for days. Maddie, you got to get out of there.
We're always saying this, and then yeah, she's like, I got to go back to Missoula. Honestly, better off for her. It's just like you come back to your cousin's hometown, and you get wrapped up in a plot where you manipulate your dead cousin's psychologist, and then you end up in a weird love triangle and record a scary song or a cute song with their friends, and then a man climbs over a couch for you. This always happens. This is like classic summer jam stuff. You know, they write songs about this stuff.
Yeah.
It's a universal experience, but yeah, she's on the way out. And James and Donna seem to be A-okay, maybe, probably.
I don't know. James, this is the last clip I have from this bit. James expresses his thoughts on love, and he's very innocent about it in a way that I find interesting.
Well, if you really love someone, it's like this bright light is shining on you all the time. You're right in it, and it's great. But I just don't think you can be that way all the time.
Sure you can.
Well, I want to. I want to try to make the way my heart feels last forever. It's pretty weird.
Pretty weird, huh?
Pretty weird.
but I think there's a lot of value in having a character like James in a show that shows love in many cases to be, not real, or showing these other really complicated and disturbing relationships around sex and that kind of stuff. To have a character who's like, yeah, love makes my heart feel good, and I'd love to feel that way all the time. I think that's nice.
Yeah, the romance stuff is, I'm liking it more on the rewatch. I think a lot of times when I watched this for my first viewing, I was like, ugh, whatever, James, Donna, don't care. But now I'm like, oh, there's like some realistic stuff here. There's some realistic and well-performed stuff here, definitely.
When I was, my first watch through, for whatever reason, I always gravitated towards Donna as like the second protagonist of the show. So
yeah,
I was pretty invested in her whole relationship with James and her getting into a bit of a jealous fight with Maddie earlier and all that. Mm-hmm.
That's a great point. I think that she, we may have talked about this in the podcast, but provides a great perspective on like, what is a world where Laura is still around, or what is a world where Laura like wasn't like brought down by the evils of the town and outside of the town.
Mm-hmm.
She would just become Donna and fall in love with a sad, sad basic man on a motorcycle.
Pretty weird.
Pretty weird.
Okay, so this Mike guy.
Yeah, so there's a guy named Mike, right? You guys know, typical name, just like from the beginning of the show, Bobby's friend, Mike. No, wait, different Mike. Actually, Philip Gerard is being interrogated in the sheriff's department by Truman, Cooper, and Gordon Cole. And Hawk, actually, is there as well. We got to remember Hawk, my man. They do some very much cop shit that we've talked about before, where they don't give him the drugs that he needs for his brain.
Yep.
Gordon Cole determines that it's a bunch of ingredients that are in haloperidol, which is an antipsychotic medication. And they don't give it to him. They have it ready, though, in case this goes badly. So I guess they're trying to be nice about it, but clearly not, because they're like, if we give it to him, we're never going to find out, but we need to know. And he has his awesome transformation sequence, if you want to call it that. It's honestly really interesting watching an actor like perform a transformation without mm-hmm. anything physically changing on their face. It's just like the way he carries his body and the way he speaks and the sort of cool synth effect on his voice as he's like screaming, becoming Mike. So Mike introduces himself as such, and Cooper immediately recognizes him from his dream. And they both recite the Fire Walk With Me poem together. And then he mentions to Cooper that him and this guy, Bob, are partners. Bob was his familiar, and he cannot reveal where Bob came from. Mm-hmm. Bob is eager for fun, and everyone runs when he smiles. We've seen him smile before. And he talks about parasites and mentions that he is the spirit inside of Philip Gerard, and Bob needs a host to feed on. They do the poem, and then he says, I saw God, and I removed my arm to get the evil out of me. And Cooper's like, is this the guy? Hey, is this the guy? And he's like, yeah, that is Bob, though. But Bob is inside of somebody else. And he has been for the last 40 years in a lodge house in the trees, a house with many similar rooms but occupied by different souls. And Cooper makes the biggest leap of logic. It's like incredible. He's like, hold on, let me see. 40 years, lodge, the Great Northern Hotel. I was impressed. That's also a cool.
By which part?
I was impressed. Well, first of all, I was impressed by the scene, but I was more saying I'm impressed by Cooper's ability to pick that out so quickly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it kind of felt, I don't know. It felt like when I would read those books that are like little mysteries and you turn the page to solve them, and I like would turn the page right away and not think about it. That was kind of what that scene felt like.
You're like, oh no, of course I would have gotten that if I just thought about it.
Yeah, no, yeah, of course. Rooms. Yeah.
A very riddle me this Batman moment.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. House with similar rooms but occupied by different souls. Like that's a hotel. Yeah, okay. I get it if you look at it like that. So Cooper's going to the Great Northern. We're gonna find the person that Bob is inside of, and we're gonna do the dang news. Wait, wrong show.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sort of feels like the like we're building, almost as if we are at the end of a season or something. Wait a minute. So we're not even. This'll be next episode is the halfway point of season two.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty exciting. Or no, sorry, the halfway point of the show, of the whole show. I'm looking at the list of episodes right now. 14 mm-hmm. and it's 29 episodes total.
Mm-hmm.
So very exciting stuff. Folks, did we have any stray notes on this episode?
Oh, one thing about the mic scene. He sees Bob's face and he says, this is his true face, but few can see it, the gifted and the damned. And then he looks into the camera like, oh,
he looks into the camera. We're the damned.
At home, you're gifted and damned. It's like, okay. All right. You scared me, I guess. Boo. I don't know.
There's a lot of characters just looking into the camera as they say something in this episode.
Yeah, it felt very like, I don't know, Bela Lugosi or something. Like the gifted and the damned.
Ooh.
Yeah,
I think he specifically looks at us when he says the damned.
Yeah,
like he says the gifted, and then he turns and says the damned. And he looks at us. Are we damned? Why are we damned? We'll find out. Probably not.
Well, because we can see Bob, I guess, is the implication, right?
True, we can literally see Bob. We see him through the TV screen.
So
themes, cool. Jen, any other notes? I don't know if you actually took notes for this one.
I think we pretty much covered most of, the Ben and Josie showdown. I just like the way that shot is framed, and while they're threatening each other, they're basically inches apart, each holding their own item that symbolizes the dirt they have on each other.
Yeah.
They're like anime villains.
Exactly.
And I like that Josie's key was like comically bigger than Ben Horn's key.
Yeah.
That was pretty funny.
Yep.
Good prop work.
Big key. Large key.
Yeah.
What could it unlock? Secrets. Yeah, that's what I got. Let's ask you, Jennifer. First of all, thank you for joining us for this discussion of Twin Peaks episode called Demons. Do you have anything to plug, first of all?
So in terms of plugs, we are gonna getting Scanline Media back up and running after a month off while we were moving stuff. You can check out what we do at scanlinemedia.com or patreon.com/scanlinemedia. And I also do a visual novel book club podcast, Novel Not New, a True End podcast, which you can find at Reading Games Online. By the time this goes up, we'll likely have the next episode available, which is going to be on Inkle's Overboard, which is a pretty neat game.
I like Inkle. They did the game where you go across the world, 80 Days.
Yep, 80 Days.
Hell yeah. Very cool. Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Scanline Network, not just because I'm on a lot of your podcasts, but because you guys all do really good work.
Oh, thank you.
Of course. You know, honestly, big inspirations for us in terms of like how we talk about media. Jen, while we have you, do you have a chatsum for the folks? I know you don't have to have one, but if you have something you want to recommend to people for the next week or so, feel free.
For sure. I recently started watching the Fear Street trilogy that's on Netflix, and I've only just finished the part one movie, but it is a pretty fantastic slasher comedy based on R.L. Stein's books. Not Goosebumps. Like, he did a Fear Street series that was targeted towards a slightly older audience at some point. But, it's just a really charming show. And it's a really charming movie. And it happens to have a queer protagonist. And they get into that. Like, what it means to be a lesbian in 1994 as a teenager. And dealing with neighbors and various acquaintances who may not be cool with the whole lesbian thing.
Hmm. That's cool.
I dig it. And that's Fear Street. Is that on Netflix, you said?
Yep, it's on Netflix. Basically, they released a trilogy of movies, each 1 week apart. And I've heard that the whole trilogy is really good, but so far I've only seen the first movie and it was pretty great.
Well, as we get into the fall season, I got to start building out my horror movie list again. So that's super useful to have and sounds really good. Magellan and I don't need to do chat sims this time because we're going to save them for the second episode that comes out this week. But we can do the usual plug zone here. I can go ahead and tell y'all if you would have questions, comments, or concerns for us, please email us at chatspot@gmail.com. That is where that you can get at us and we'll read your comments on the air. We also have a Twitter, which is at chatspod, C-H-A-T-Z-P-O-D. We have a subreddit, r/chatspod. And we're on all the podcast platforms. Please rate us, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. We have a Patreon, which is full of fun bonus content. It's patreon.com/chatspod. And you can get bonus content at just $3 a month. That's right, folks, $3 a month. That gets you Magellan's Solo X-Files pod. That gets you us hanging out and talking about stuff pod. It gets us piloting things, and it gets you voting ability. Because every month we have a theme now, and we started doing this thing where we spin a wheel. Magellan has like a fun wheel in his house that he spins, and you guys pick what's on the wheel. We did the theme for the month of August was pirates, and I believe that the commentary should be out at this point. Yeah. For 1944 is The Princess and the Pirate, which was again voted for by patrons. If you're a $5 patron on there, you get a thank you on the main episode. So hey guys. Thank you very much to our $5 patrons, Kat, Marcus, Nick, Pat, Fendon, Ryan, Six, also from Scanline Media, shout out, and Stefan. Thank y'all for supporting Chats at Television Podcast. That's what we got, folks. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you again for Jennifer Uncle for being on the pod. And that was a damn fine podcast.
Hey, everyone, now we're going to spoil stuff. So that includes anything from seasons 1 and 2 of Twin Peaks and Fire Walk With Me. We're not going to spoil the return, but just so you know, so you don't spoil something you didn't want to spoil. What did I want to talk about in this one? Just Leland singing and Mike being like, hey, Bob likes to smile. Did you get it? Lyrics of getting to know you. Haven't you noticed suddenly I'm bright and breezy?
Sometimes it feels off. Maybe it feels obvious to us because we know.
No, I know. I mean, I think, yeah, I didn't notice these things the first time I watched. I'm just saying I.
But it is there now on a rewatch. Yeah,
they're putting all all the clues there. And then it was an interesting turn of phrase when Mike says that Bob likes the pleasures and the pleasures are his children.
Oh, shit.
Oh, God. I never even thought about that.
That was.
Whoa.
Yeah, right?
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. But right now you basically have two choices. It's Ben or it's Leland. And both of them, well, we know that Ben like might be weird with his kids, so you could still very much think it's Ben up until this point.
Yeah, I think they were intentionally putting in some red herrings to make you think that it's Ben. I mean, one of the big ones, obviously, is that the episode ends with them saying, oh, he's in the Great Northern. Oh my God, Ben.
But Leland's also in the Great Northern.
Right. And all this stuff with Ben Horn's so creepy, and what's the place called? One-Eyed Jacks. And I think even the scene where, is that the next episode where Leland kills
Maddie? Yes, that's the next episode.
They shot an alternate version of that scene where it's Ben Horn.
Yeah.
So
I heard about that. I don't know if that's like on a deleted scene thing or something.
I don't know.
Jen, did you know about that?
I did not know about that at all. Wow. Okay.
Three versions of it, I think. It was one with Leland, one with Ben, and one with Bob.
I'll need to check my Blu-ray copies deleted scenes and see if they have that there, because that'd be awesome if they do.
Yeah.
Lonely Souls is a big one. I kind of like wanted, I think I mentioned it in that episode last week, but like people who haven't watched before, I wanted to be like, hey, just a heads up, please pay attention. Watch Lonely Souls if you're not watching already.
Yeah.
We're on the precipice, gang. After Lonely Souls, the show is out of steam. It's done. There's no more show.
Yeah. Should we talk about Mr. Tajimura?
Yes.
Yes.
So this is the first time I was basically looking through the credits because I never thought about how they were crediting Piper Laurie throughout this whole arc.
Yep.
And apparently they just gave her a Japanese alias, Fumio Yamaguchi.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
I noticed that for the first time last week. I brought it up in the last spoiler zone. But yes, it's kind of, it's funny, but also like, come on, guys. Come on. Do you remember, Jen, if it's ever explicitly revealed? Magellan said he doesn't remember if they ever just say it, that it's Catherine.
Oh, they, there's a bit later on where you basically see Mr. Tojimura take off all the makeup and stuff, and there's Catherine, it's Catherine underneath.
Oh,
like,
I remember that.
I think that's the scene that got Piper Laurie the Golden Globes in 1991.
What?
For this show.
Oh my God. For this that performance?
Sucks.
Yeah.
That's terrible. Oh, yeah. Jesus Christ. She's doing the like swap the L's with R's thing. And it's like, what's the performance here? Some fucking Mickey Rooney ass.
Yeah,
shit that she's doing
it,
here.
It is sucks. Mickey. Exactly. It's Mickey Rooney. It's like everything's interesting. She doesn't move, I guess, because like obviously it's all her sitting and she's just very still and like just espousing Orientalist nonsense. Some fans have like dug into the whole line about the my parents were at Nagasaki thing.
Yeah.
It's bad. The stuff that fans come up with there is not that bad. It's interesting, but I can't talk about it because it kind of dips into return stuff. Jen, I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yep. Yeah. That comes back in the return in some way, but yeah.
I think, Alan, later, can I tell you what I think you mean?
Yeah, you can tell me what you think.
But we don't have to talk about it right now.
Yeah. But yeah, the Mr. Touch, that's the stuff where it's honestly fans trying to be like, no, wait, it's actually good. It's not just a really wildly, wildly racist bit of yellow face. Like, no, it's actually interesting. They were going for something. It's like, guys, come on. You're doing the work that the showrunners weren't doing. You can't, that doesn't,
yeah.
I don't, that doesn't square with me. This is offensive.
This exact arc is like, it shows up in TV later, but in terms of like the non-laugh track sort of shows, like It's Always Sunny, where a character is clearly doing an awful thing and the show is constantly singling, this is awful, right? This is so awful that you're watching this right now and that it's happening. But here it's treated like a big, like, oh, here's these showrunners putting together this amazing mystery and reveal to you. Like, oh, the wool was over your eyes this whole time. And just from moment one, like, earlier on in the season, when you see Mr. Tojimura walk in, it's immediately an oh no moment.
Yeah.
Right. The makeup looks fake as hell. I mean, maybe if I was watching this on like a chunky CRT, it wouldn't be as obvious to me, but
sure.
That close up where Pete's looking at her under the makeup, it's like, this looks like Play-Doh. And it is terrible.
I'm curious if people who have never watched the show before know that that's not, that that's makeup. Like, I'm legit curious.
I can't remember when we watched it. We must have looked it up or something, because
we spoiled so much stuff for ourselves.
Yeah.
But originally when I watched the show, it was a situation where I was seeing those scenes and I was like, I don't know what's going on here, but considering that there are other Asian actors in the show, it immediately stands out that the person here is not Asian. And then when the reveal with Catherine happened, it was like, holy shit, no, this is bad. This is real bad.
Yeah.
Big facts. Yeah, you can kind of tell the stuff that they're like, they erase later on in the show, and Mr. Tajimura, once it's handled, they're like, all right, that's, we'll just punt that for the rest of the time. That's done now. Also, like, I'm digging here, but that's what we do in the spoiler zone. Leo being inside of his own head very much gives me the, like, Cooper in, you know, Bob inside of Cooper vibe, which, again, like, not going to talk too much in detail about because some of that gets into their turn. But even just, like, at the end of season two, when Bob possesses Cooper, it's like, oh, shit, there's a person inside of my, like, there's a soul inside of the husk of a body. Mm. I think that's a very common thing that Twin Peaks likes to play with. Also, there are two Magellans in our Google Doc right now, and I'm wondering if one of them is your spirit body, Magellan.
He's my familiar. Yeah. No, on my monitor, my screen is split between my notes part on one side and my soundboard reference on the other side.
Oh, sure. Okay.
So I'm looking at two parts of the document at once.
Gotcha.
Wyndham Earl, can we stop?
Why are
can
you so not? Bummed about Wyndham Earl? Why don't you want him?
Because, okay, Alan, I have a question for you.
Yeah, okay.
I want you to answer honestly. Is the Wyndham Earl stuff good?
I don't know.
Okay. I don't remember it being good.
I don't think it's great, but also at the same time, as a break from the Catherine's whole arc,
yeah.
It's something that it's a poor replacement for the Leland Palmer mystery, but it has its own camp energy to it, just like him sending him like
the chess
postcards with the chess moves and all that.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it's fair. Goofy. Like, isn't there like a giant chess piece at some point, and he does like elaborate traps for people, like, oh of gosh. all of the weird stuff in back half of season two, I think the Wyndham Earl stuff is at least some of the most fun.
Mom, come pick me up. Wyndham Earl is sending me chess moves through the mail.
She's not coming, Magellan. I'm sorry.
Twin Peaks reboot where Wyndham Earl is just playing, is sending Words with Friends moves to Cooper.
Oh my god.
Right.
Ba-ding!
Oh my god. That's what I got. I don't know if there are any other spoilers.
Was trying to talk around it, but Gordon Cole is like at the center every time there's a big reveal. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he comes back. He's like pretty big in Firewalk with Me, and then he's pretty big in like the later Bob stuff. So, like I was saying, David Lynch just gets to be there when important things are happening in the story.
Yeah.
Love Gordon Cole, love very much. But we get for some like Blue Rose lore stuff. Oh, it gets good. There is good stuff in there, folks. Don't leave. Don't quit the show. Watch the. You have to watch the back half of season two with us. It makes the good parts of season three that much more exciting when you've been like in hell world for fucking like 10 weeks. I promise you that. That's what I got. Oh, yeah, Jen.
Oh, I was just going to say that the way that season three makes good on some of the relationship stuff with Andy and Lucy is pretty fantastic.
Also, speaking of Mr. Tajimura, Jen, you mentioned Denise at the top of the episode, which I was like debating cutting, but also you just said the name. I don't think that's worth a cut necessarily. I'll decide that in the edit. But like in season two, we deal with somebody dressing outside of their birth gender in a different way than they do with Mr. Tajimura.
Right.
I don't want to say it's not transphobic because they change the way that they talk about it throughout this franchise. But I will really have to talk about Denise. We might need to get some other people on to help us talk about Denise at some point too.
Yeah.
Like, I have good memories of the Denise stuff, like some good mixed memories, but also like I think that might also just be the way that they also return to that in season three. And David Lynch uses the character of Gordon Cole to face the camera and be like, transphobes should fucking die.
Yeah. Right. So let's not dip too much into return talk just now, but we will loop back to all these fun discussions and more next time on Peaks Chats.
See you on Wednesday. Everyone. Bye.
See ya.